concerned that the British government may be complicit in human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia, citing lack of clarity over what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in the kingdom. In a report published recently, some campaigners said that at a time when the human rights situation is deteriorating in Saudi Arabia, uncertainty about what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund is supporting in the kingdom raises questions about whether Britain is bolstering institutions involved in the abuses. The report added that the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund, which has so far given £70 million to six Persian Gulf states, has been criticised by members of parliament and by human rights groups for leaving the public largely in the dark about how it is run and taxpayer money is spent. The latest report comes as women's rights are removed from a description of what the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund supports in Saudi Arabia, a week after Riyadh sentenced a Leeds University student and women's rights activist to 34 years in prison for following and retweeting the critics of the kingdom on Twitter. In June of last year, the British government published the Persian Gulf Strategy Fund's supports, saying it bolsters the strategic partnership and delivers mutual prosperity and security by supporting Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 reforms across priority sectors in line with British values, including women's rights. But in the Saudi Arabia section of the news summary published on 26th of August, a week after Salma al-Shahab's 34-year prison sentence over her tweets made headlines, women's rights are no longer referenced at all. Lina al-Hathloul, head of monitoring and communications for the human rights group Al-Aqsd, said the newly published summary still doesn't provide clear and transparent answers and questioned how the Persian Gulf Strategic Fund is supporting human rights in Saudi Arabia. Dana Ahmad, West Asia and Persian Gulf researcher at Amnesty International, described the fund extremely concerning, saying Saudi Arabia's dire human rights record of silencing dissenting voices, executing individuals and ruthlessly crushing basic human rights of citizens and residents needs to be thoroughly addressed. Hungry humans. Part 2.
This is the battlefield. A manifestation of humans' cruelty. Everything happens fast and in a riotous way in the battlefield. But sometimes wars are silent and hidden with an attractive and charming look. Such wars are sometimes more threatening and result in more victims. Like the war that I want to tell you about. A war that you may not have even imagined, but we are in the middle of the battlefield. I want to start my story with a question. Why is fast food so popular in this era? One recipe and one taste. Everything is similar. Ready-to-eat foods are without stories because there is no time to tell stories in the middle of the battlefield. We can find them in these hypermarkets. There is no story here. The story of each product is summarized in barcodes and a few lines and numbers below them. It doesn't matter where the food comes from, they say here instead of everywhere. Here, like on the battlefield, everything happens fast.
So I would not say that it caused the Industrial Revolution, but I would go so far as to say that in England, it helped make the Industrial Revolution possible because it sustained the people who were doing the industry. When factory workers got off shift, the last thing they really wanted to do was cook. And right outside the factory gates were people who had set up carts with ovens, and they would bake the potatoes, and they would sell them for cheap. And people would have a hot baked potato coming right off the factory floor, a nice instant treat. And that was, in a sense, the beginning of modern street food. So the pace of life began to increase. I think the industrialization happened first, and the potato became necessary for it to continue or made it easier.
Can you give us a talk about the suffering imposed, for example, to hands in factory farming?
In some cases, the confinement is very tight. An example of that would be for hens who are laying eggs. So the standard industrial cage, and that's not just for one hen, that might be for four or five hens. So each hen in this cage has just a very small amount of space. They're very crowded together, and they can't even stretch their wings. In fact, some of the cages are so small that even one bird in the cage could not stretch her wings fully. And instead of there being one bird, there are four or five birds.
One out of eight people in today's world is either very fat or very thin. The rest of the people may not be fat or thin, but they do not use diverse nutrition resources. It means that in today's world, everyone is hungry in some way, even if they don't know it themselves. Considering the amount of destruction of Earth and the resources and this amount of mass production of food, why should people be hungry? Mass and abundant production cannot be a warning. The age of mass production. In this era, mass profit was only possible with mass production. So every obstacle in the way of mass production had to be removed. Machine-processed foods were the same in size and ingredients. They were produced and consumed with the same strategy. This means that the consumer's tastes should have been similar to each other. From then on, the good food was cooked as fast as possible and was also easy to eat. The hero of this story was sausage. Sausage is a standardized food that everyone without any taste likes. Its components cannot be distinguished from each other, and it can be produced and consumed very quickly. but food like calipoche has characteristics that make it different from sausage. It is not a dish that everyone likes. It takes a long time to cook this dish. The ones who eat this kind of meal know exactly what they're going to eat. If I want to eat sheep's eyes, I know exactly what part of the sheep I want to eat. I can know about the different parts of a sheep's body. Many don't like this dish and never enter a tabakhi. In a tabakhi, the cook plays a very important role. Most of the time, he is the hero of the story. Customers know the story of calipoche with its cook. The green eyes of the cook are part of the taste of the food that is eaten. A concept like local customers was against the trend that wanted to make food global. The good food is loved by all people everywhere in the world. Food that can be mass-produced, mass-sold, and mass-profitable. The new era is about machines and pace. In this period, the good food is in harmony with machines. It means that it can be produced with the help of a machine and can be eaten in cars. The story of unifying the tastes of all the people of the world started from serving food inside of vehicles. McDonald's was the first restaurant that started serving food in the cars. An idea that, after a few decades, turned this restaurant into the second largest private restaurant in the world. Now McDonald's has 37,800 branches in 119 countries. These branches provide food with similar tastes to 64 million customers around the world on a daily basis. McDonald's quickly removed taste and chef from the story of food. In this age, no one asks himself why all the people everywhere in the world should love the same kind of food. This fast food company went beyond a way of consuming food and became a lifestyle. George Ritzer, American sociologist, uses McDonaldization as a new concept to explain McDonald's impacts on different communities. He believes that McDonald's influence is expanded. In this opinion, in the new age, everything is becoming part of McDonaldization.
You know, one of the criticisms of McDonald's and fast food industry is that they have industrialized food. Well, McDonaldization, as I've defined it, is the process by which the principles of the fast food restaurant have come to dominate that industry. But not only that industry, many other industries and many other parts of society, and also has come to be dominate globally. You know, any business, especially in the food industry, especially that seeks to be global in nature, has to McDonaldize its operation.
According to George Ritzer, every successful business at the global level is inevitably forced to be under McDonaldization theory. I asked him what other things have changed in the world apart from the business under the term of McDonaldization.
The sandwiches are pretty much the same from one time to another time and from one place to another place. And so it turns out that if you, and McDonald's is in about 120 countries in the world, and it turns out that if you order a Big Mac or anything, it's pretty much going to be similar or the same from one country to another country. One of the many negative points of view is it's led to a global decline in taste as far as food is concerned. I don't know what kind of impact it's had in Iran because you don't have McDonald's, and I don't think you have, I don't think any of the copies that you have there are as powerful as McDonald's is. But, you know, in most part of the world, it's not destroyed indigenous food and cuisine. It's certainly limited the interest in it, especially among young people. What McDonald's has done, what fast food restaurants have done, is to alter behavior and in the process alter people's values. So, for example, people increasingly value things that are fast. They want things done quickly, and in part that's a product of a fast food society where the emphasis at least on things that are fast. So people become accustomed to getting food fast, and so they want all kinds of other things fast as well.
Speed is a modern phenomenon that has become a disaster for human lives and the Earth. Speed in food production and consumption means harming Mother Earth. It means the ruination of water, soil, and the environment. Fast food causes the loss of diversity and cultural values and even increases the number of hungry people, and it harms people's health. Many years passed until they knew about this widespread destruction. People looked for a quick solution to prevent this destruction. Preventing widespread meat eating and finding an alternative to it was the first thing that came to their minds in this era. So movements were formed to announce this alternative. These movements, which are sometimes accompanied by famous figures, seek to eliminate animal meat and replace it with other creatures. Insects are one of the serious proposals to be used instead of the meat of animals. Those people who are the fans of entomophagy believe the land and resources used to produce 200 grams of beef are equal to the land and resources used to grow 2,000 grams of insects. So it is probably better to raise and eat insects to raise cattle.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump on Friday, 14th of October, issued what he characterized as his official response to the January 6th Select Committee after a panel voted to subpoena him. But he didn't say if he'll testify to the January 6th panel. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The British newspaper The Guardian has more on the story. Donald Trump is considering testifying in front of the House January 6th committee, which this week concluded a dramatic hearing establishing what it says is his culpability for a deadly Capitol attack by voting to subpoena the former president. On Friday, 14th of October, sources close to Donald Trump confirmed to The Guardian that he may choose to appear before the congressional panel. Such an appearance would set up an unprecedented high-stakes political event. Donald Trump, meanwhile, issued an angry and rambling public letter to Benny Thompson, the Mississippi Democrat who chairs the January 6th panel. Since last June, Thompson's committee has laid out in extraordinary detail the chaos, the fear and violence of a day now linked to 9 deaths. Regardless, under the title Peacefully and Patriotically, Trump reeled off a string of abuse, lies, unsubstantiated claims, and outright conspiracy theories about the 2020 presidential election and the 6th of January 2021. In a predictably intemperate introduction, Donald Trump said the presidential election of 2020 was rigged and stolen. It was not. He also cited the Russia investigation over 2016 presidential election, interference and links between Trump and Moscow, impeachment hoax number one, his impeachment for blackmailing Ukraine for political dirt, impeachment hoax number two, for inciting the Capitol attack, the atrocious and illegal spying on my campaign, a debunked claim, and so much more. He called the members of Benny Thompson's committee highly partisan political hacks and thugs whose sole function is to destroy the lives of many hard-working American patriots. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, rejected Republican attempts to place Trump allies on the January 6th committee, including congressmen implicated in his attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election, the fuel for the Capitol attack. Two anti-Trump Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, sit on the House panel. Testimony presented has been overwhelmingly from Republicans and members of Trump's White House and administration. Donald Trump has sent cease and desist letters to media outlets, including The Guardian, that call him a liar in print. Nonetheless, his letter rehashed his big lie about election fraud. Appendices listing debunked claims about Arizona, Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Michigan, key states in Joe Biden's conclusive win. In an echo of Trump's famous refusal to admit that the crowd of his inauguration in 2016 was actually smaller than that for Barack Obama in 2008, the former president also exaggerated the size of the crowd which heard him speak near the White House on 6th of January 2021, the speech in which he told his supporters to fight like hell. The website Politico.com has more on the same story. The January 6th Select Committee's subpoena of Donald Trump is not a play to secure his testimony. It's a dare for the former president. Rebut our case against you if you can. We have left no doubt, none, that Donald Trump led an effort to upend American democracy that directly resulted in the violence on 6th of January 2021. The House panel's chair, Representative Benny Thompson, said on Thursday as members approved the subpoena. He tried to take away the voice of the American people and replace the will of the voters with his own will to remain in power. He is the one person at the center of the story of what happened on 6th of January 2021. After a year-long investigation that's amassed extraordinary evidence of Donald Trump's multi-front drive to subvert the 2020 election, the unanimous subpoena is a symbolic capstone that signals the panel's final phase. Beyond the historic weight of the committee's bid to make Trump the fourth former president to ever testify before Congress, its members and aides are under little illusion they will successfully obtain Trump's testimony. Any legal effort to compel Donald Trump is likely to take years, far longer than the 2.5 months until the Select Committee sunsets at the end of the current Congress. Some of the Select panel held out hope, with tongues perhaps slightly in cheeks, that Donald Trump might willingly appear for a deposition without necessitating the drag-out court fights that have defined his career. After all, they noted, he facilitated lengthy testimony by his son Donald Jr. and his daughter Ivanka Trump, without asserting any privileges that might have limited his children's testimony. I would consider it a great honor and privilege to testify if somebody accused me of trying to overthrow a presidential election and subvert the government in the United States, said Representative Jamie Raskin, a Democrat from Maryland. Jamie Raskin added, so I have every reason to believe that every American citizen would comply with the subpoena. Others close to the committee joked privately that Donald Trump might relish the ratings such public testimony would draw, even if it cut against his legal and political interests as he barrels towards another likely presidential run. The website Axios.com examines the story from a different angle. Former President Donald Trump on Friday issued what he characterized as his official response to the January 6th Select Committee after the panel voted to subpoena him. In the 14-page letter addressed to Representative Benny Thompson, a Democrat from Mississippi, the chair of the House panel, Donald Trump rehashed a multitude of critiques he and his Republican allies have previously lodged against the panel. After an 8-page appendix laying out unfounded claims of fraud in the 2020 presidential election, he wrote, "At your request, I will present these additional numbers to you. It's not clear whether the panel has even issued its subpoena of Donald Trump yet, making the reply potentially premature." Benny Thompson said on Thursday that the subpoena would be issued as soon as we get the paperwork. He told the website Axios that the panel has not had prior communications with Donald Trump's legal team, aside from the ex-president's litigation to shield White House records. Spokespeople for the January 6th House Committee did not immediately respond to requests for comment.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
rising rivalries between the U.S. and China are set to dominate the coming years in the 21st century. That is because the U.S. has unveiled its long-delayed national security strategy, where China is named as the most consequential geopolitical challenge for the regime in Washington. That means that Washington is prioritizing winning over China, as Beijing is seen as the only global rival to the U.S. Jake Sullivan, the U.S. National Security Advisor, said, "The People's Republic of China harbors the intention and increasingly the capacity to reshape the international order in favor of one that tilts the global playing field to its benefit." The U.S. strategy further insists that China represents the most consequential challenge to the global order. It also says the U.S. must win the economic arms race with the superpower if it hopes to retain its global influence. The strategy has warned that China's rapid advances in technology is aimed at molding the world order. The strategy is in line with the rhetoric pursued by the Biden administration and its predecessor. Biden officials have accused Russia and China of looking to change the so-called rules-based order. The term has come to be seen as a synonym for Washington-led world order. The Biden administration has entangled itself in a number of global crises, including the war in Ukraine. The Washington regime encouraged the war in Ukraine by sending more weapons into the conflict zone. Washington is using the crisis to contain Russia. And by encouraging its allies to sever their energy ties with Moscow, Washington is trying to push European countries into its own sphere of influence. Furthermore, Washington is stoking tensions in the East Asia region by strengthening its ties with the Chinese Taipei. Back in August 2022, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, drawing an angry reaction from China. Beijing has warned that it will not tolerate Washington's meddlesome interference in its own affairs. But Washington's increasingly belligerent behavior in Europe and East Asia has pushed Russia and China closer together. They have forged closer ties in a variety of fields, including energy, business, and defense areas. Furthermore, both Moscow and Beijing are key members of the BRICS groups of countries and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Two bodies are playing key roles in shifting the Western-led balance toward a multipolar world. Russia and China have also forged closer ties with countries like Iran and India, which are emerging powers in the shifting geostrategic relations worldwide. It is now widely believed that Washington's ambitions to still lead the world is facing tough challenges. It appears that the regime in Washington has no longer the capability that it once possessed to dictate its hegemony.
Iran hosting the 36th International Conference on Islamic Unity in the capital, Tehran, which hosts 200 Shia and Sunni clerics, as well as thinkers from some 60 different countries. The annual event puts into discussion the challenges faced by the Muslim world. It's widely believed that uniting Muslims in the region and worldwide would be a great step in alleviating the problems they're facing. Violence and wars are killing Muslims in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. Imam Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic, proposed the idea in the 1980s to bring Muslims together against the imperialist aggressions and interventions of Western powers. Over the years, Iran has championed the cause of Islamic unity and brotherhood. This is when many other Muslim countries have brazenly become facilitators and enablers of America's neo-imperialism. The highlight of this year's event was a speech by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to the participants of the conference. During his speech, President Raisi hailed resistance as the only viable path to confronting the Israeli regime. Raisi further said that history has proven wrong those countries who assumed that negotiations would save Palestine.
The biggest human rights violators are the U.S., Israel, and some Western countries, despite their claims to be human rights defenders. See their record, what they have done to their own people and the people around the globe.
Raisi also referred to previous deals reached with the Tel Aviv regime on the issue of Palestine, saying the regime has refused to honor the commitments it has made. He also criticized the Arab governments that normalized their ties with Israel and the Zionist regime. He said the U.S. and the Israeli regime are trying to marginalize Palestinians through normalization deals. Raisi was referring to the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan and Morocco, which normalized their ties with Israel in late 2020 under deals pushed by former US President Donald Trump. One of the issues that was highlighted in this conference was how Muslims in Palestine are brutally oppressed by the Israeli regime, which is supported by the West and some regional Arab states that have betrayed the cause of Palestine. The normalization deals with the Israeli regime has emboldened Tel Aviv to carry out more war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories.
It's no surprise to us that the House of Saud has teamed up with the Israeli regime. They claim to be Muslims, but in fact they are the puppets of the Israelis and do what Tel Aviv dictates to them.
So far this year, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds amid a massive increase in Israeli military raids. Israel has killed five times as many Palestinians in 2022 than it killed in the same period in 2021. And on the issue of Palestinian prisoners, nearly 300 rights groups have condemned the continued detention of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. They called on the international community to act against the crimes of Israel. The groups also censured Israel for its administrative detention of Palestinians. Conferences like the one held in Iran helped the Palestinian cause by continuing to point to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. If the Palestinian cause is not the most important issue for Muslims and the wider world, then Israeli forces will continue using excessive force in their dealings with the Palestinians without being held accountable.
The French leaders have seemingly found a solution to the country's energy crisis. Puffer jackets and turtlenecks have become the newest fashion trend in the Élysée, as ministers and the president try to imply a message to the public: wrap up warm for winter. That's while, as the cold season approaches, the nation struggles to afford heating. French motorists have been made to wait in long lines across the country to refuel their vehicles as petrol pumps run dry amid ongoing strikes at the country's oil refineries and storage sites. Almost a third of the petrol stations had problems getting deliveries of fuel as tanker drivers continue their strike over low wages and harsh working conditions amid a cost-of-living crisis in France. So, to cut the long story short, Macron is up to his neck in trouble, and his government's winter wardrobe messaging has drawn accusations of being out of touch with everyday reality. The country's far-right opposition leader, Marine Le Pen, mocked the government saying, "Don't have enough heating? Let them wear cashmere." And Gaspard Ganser, an advisor to former President François Hollande, labeled the idea grotesque and paternalistic. Paris has come up with an energy efficiency plan to get through the winter without blackouts. Homes and offices heated to a maximum of 19 Celsius degrees. No hot water in public buildings, no lit advertising overnight, a ban on doors left open in heated or air-conditioned shops, reduced temperatures in swimming pools and gyms. These are some examples of the action France is taking to save energy. However, environmentalists have accused the French government of promoting tiny measures while failing to take enough action on the climate crisis. They say unenforced and voluntary measures are ineffective. Also, scores of French intellectuals have urged the nation to rise in protest against President Emmanuel Macron's failure to improve economic conditions amid rising inflation. The current situation troubles the French government as a foretaste of problems to come, a potential winter of discontent. Now, the question is, will Macron get his head out of his turtleneck? Thousands of demonstrators gathered in Paris to protest soaring inflation and high cost of living, demanding that France pull out completely from membership in the US-led NATO military alliance. They demanded that President Emmanuel Macron resign, calling on his government to stop supplying arms to Ukraine. Ever since the Ukrainian crisis began, causing a severe energy crisis across Europe, anti-NATO sentiments have been rising among Europeans. Similar protests have been held across the European Union against soaring inflation and the rising cost of living caused by sanctions imposed on Russia in the wake of the Ukraine war. Since the beginning of the war in Ukraine in late February, Western countries have slapped waves of sanctions on Russia. In response, Moscow has either choked up or lessened its gas exports to the rest of Europe, saying it would only resume the gas flow after the economic sanctions were lifted. Disruption in supply chains has led to higher fuel and food prices across the EU, driving inflation to record levels and causing the cost of living to soar. The European Union leaders accused the Kremlin of wielding energy as a weapon, cutting gas supplies in retaliation for sanctions. The protesters also called on the US-led NATO coalition to immediately stop supplying arms to Ukraine and to work to resolve the simmering crisis through diplomacy.
I have three priorities for our economy. Growth, growth, and growth.
Flip-flopping and humiliating U-turn are the terms used by members of parliament and various media outlets on Liz Truss's 180 on her 45% tax cut for the rich. Truss and her chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng thought that a tax cut for the rich would create more jobs and then eventually lead up to tax cuts for the general public as a part of her trickle-down economic plans in what is being referred to in the media as mini-budget.
How is that fair that you get a tax cut of over 2,000 while people on average income see much less?
So everybody is getting a tax cut, and the situation that we were in was we were putting up taxes. That was the immediate situation that we were in. We were facing a situation where the tax burden was at a 70-year high, and that was completely unacceptable. The Prime Minister campaigned for the leadership on the basis that we were going to reduce taxes, and that's exactly what we've done.
Truss and Kwarteng were quickly forced to turn back on their decision as the plan was received very poorly by Truss's own Tory party, who threatened to vote against the tax cuts.
I don't comment on market movements, but what is good for the economy?
Who caused it?
What is good for the economy?
The tax cuts would have been the largest set of unfunded tax cuts for the rich in over 50 years and a huge gamble on public finances and the health of UK economy, according to Welsh Finance Minister Rebecca Evans. When the news broke out about her tax cut plans, the British pound hit a record low against the dollar, prompting a $73 billion budget allocation by Bank of England to shore up the markets before the pound partially recovered. The British Premier, however, blamed communication errors in how the package was presented, and some communication error that was, the kind that shocked markets and voters and couldn't get her the support she needed by her own Conservative Party before she had to back off on it. The controversy in her economic plan comes after the worst start to a new administration in recent memory in the UK, with people already questioning how long Britain's new Prime Minister will remain in office. One might even say trust is fading in Truss. The UK's GDP growth has been on a slow but steady decline since 2014, from 1% down to 0%. It was the pandemic, however, that completely flatlined the UK economy, causing the single biggest slump in its GDP since its GDP was recorded in 1961. By extension, according to the Office for National Statistics, the UK consumer price inflation hit just over 10% in the 12 months to July. That is the highest inflation rate in the country since the early 80s. Things aren't much different outside the UK, across the Green Continent. Certainly, the pandemic caused its own set of problems for European economy, but perhaps it was the Ukraine war and the subsequent food and energy crisis that really cemented Europe's ongoing and expected economic downturn. Drastic plans to manage the crisis is being implemented across Europe. 3-hour power cuts to homes and businesses are expected during this winter in the UK. Germany rationed hot water, dimmed streetlights, and shut down swimming pools. French people are using more and more wood and less gas to heat their homes. Buildings in Italy will have 15 extra days without central heating. This all begs the question, is the insistence of the West on prolonging the Ukraine war really worth the damages it is causing their economy and their people?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's incorrect performance in the field of foreign, domestic, and economic policy has caused his popularity to drop extensively. President Biden's approval rating has remained below 50% since August of 2021, a warning sign that his Democratic Party could lose control of at least one chamber of the U.S. Congress in the November 8 midterm elections. Thus, Republicans are expected to achieve victories in the midterm elections this November. If they take control of the U.S. House of Representatives, more than two-thirds of them believe that Joe Biden should be impeached. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. MSNBC, an American news-based television channel based in New York, has this to say. U.S. Republicans hoping to seize control of the House of Representatives this November are already setting their sights on what is, for many of them, a top priority next year: impeaching the current president, Joe Biden. A number of rank-and-file conservatives have already introduced impeachment articles in the current Congress against President Biden. Those resolutions never had a chance of seeing the light of day, with Democrats holding a narrow control of the lower chamber. But with Republicans widely expected to win the House majority in the midterm elections, many of the same conservatives wanted to tap their new potential powers to oust a president they deem unfit. Some would like to make it a first order of business. The article quoted a variety of GOP lawmakers and their spokespersons, including Representative Bob Good of Virginia, insisting that the Democratic president should be impeached for intentionally opening the U.S. border with Mexico, despite the fact that this has never happened in reality. As regular leaders may recall, this isn't altogether new. One of the first Republican lawmakers to broach the subject of impeaching Joe Biden was Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, who raised the prospect 2 years ago, long before the Delaware Democrat had even secured his party's nomination. The GOP senator, Joni Ernst, said at the time that the impeachment door has been opened and pointed to conspiracy theories about Burisma, a holding company, and Ukraine. Also, after Joe Biden's inauguration, several House Republicans filed articles of impeachment against the Democratic president, and earlier this year, Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas added that he believed the Republican-led House would likely consider impeaching Joe Biden on multiple grounds. Senator Ted Cruz added a few weeks ago that in the wake of the FBI's Mar-a-Lago search, the pressure to impeach Joe Biden is going to be enormous. Representative Jim Jordan, a Republican position to the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, has said he wants to see his party at least begin a conversation about impeaching President Biden. The Hill has more on this story. At least 8 resolutions to impeach Joe Biden have been offered since he took office. 3 related to his handling of the migrant surge at the southern border with Mexico, 3 targeting his management of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan last year, 1 denouncing the eviction moratorium designed to help renters during the pandemic, and still another connected to the overseas business dealings of his son, Hunter Biden. Those proposals will expire with the end of this Congress, but some of the sponsors are already vowing to revisit them quickly next year. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican from Georgia, the lead sponsor of 4 of the impeachment resolutions, is among them. Nick Dyer, a Green spokesman, said recently in an email, "Marjorie Taylor Greene believes Joe Biden should have been impeached as soon as he was sworn into office, so of course she wants it to happen as soon as possible." A noisy impeachment push for the GOP's right flank could create headaches for Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican leader in line to be Speaker of the House, and other party brass just as the 2024 presidential cycle heats up. Another strategy GOP leaders may adopt is to impeach a high-ranking member of the administration, but not the president himself. Several resolutions have been introduced to do just that, separately targeting Vice President Kamala Harris, the Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, and Attorney General Merrick Garland. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. A rare anti-Trump Republican congressman predicted US Republicans will try to impeach Joe Biden every week if they retake the House of Representatives this November. Remembering repeated attempts to defund the Affordable Care Act under Barack Obama, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois said, "That's going to look like child's play in terms of what Marjorie Taylor Greene is going to demand of Kevin McCarthy." Kinzinger added, "They're going to demand an impeachment vote on President Biden every week." Adam Kinzinger was speaking to David Axelrod, a former Obama advisor, on his Access File podcast. Kinzinger is one of two Republicans on the House committee investigating the Capitol attack that Donald Trump incited. He will retire this November. The other Republican, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, lost her primary to a Trump-backed challenger. Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia is among far-right Republicans who have already introduced or threatened impeachment articles against Joe Biden on issues including the COVID pandemic, immigration, Afghanistan, and misdemeanor of Biden's son, Hunter Biden. Adam Kinzinger added, "I think it will be a very difficult majority for him to govern unless he just chooses to go absolutely crazy with them, in which case you may see the rise of the silent, non-existent, moderate Republican that may still exist out there, but I don't know. Democrats impeached Donald Trump twice. Adam Kinzinger voted against the first impeachment over the blackmail of Ukraine for political purposes, but for the second over the Capitol attack. He told David Axelrod he regretted the first vote. Nine other House Republicans voted for Donald Trump's second impeachment, making it the most bipartisan in history. At trial in the Senate, seven Republicans found Trump guilty, but that was not enough for a conviction. Discussing Adam Kinzinger's work on the January 6th committee, David Axelrod pointed to a recent opinion poll which said 72% of Republican voters still back Donald Trump's lie about election fraud and say Joe Biden is not the legitimate president of America.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena? And how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well.